Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight. Tonight our speaker is Dr. Paul Toomey, a most successful Australian with an international reputation. I'll introduce him briefly. We were talking that around 25 years ago thereabouts, we were both visiting, he was working in refugee camps on the Thai-Cambodian border. I was visiting him on official business. So he's worked in with refugees, but his qualifications are many and varied. Educated at the University of Queensland, a master's at Penn State from the United States, a PhD from Cambridge. He's worked with McKinsey & Company, with Austrade, with the National Office of the Information Economy, and currently at ICANN. And Dr. Toomey's current precise title is Senior President, International Cooperation for Sign Names and Numbers, ICANN. And tonight he's going to talk for us on the world through the lens of the internet. Dr. Toomey, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Jerry, and thank you, everybody, for the invitation and to be here. And excuse me while I play with the technology. I thought I'd just take the opportunity to talk a little bit about a couple of key themes that I think are quite relevant, both about the internet itself and then also what its implications are for Australia. And I suppose they're sort of the summation of the points. The internet is the only global technology. And I'm going to talk about that to some degree because it is a radical and fundamental concept that most people sort of listen to and say, yeah, that's fine, until they actually understand what it really means. It has regional characteristics and priorities for everyone. That's worth talking about those briefly. It reflects its foundational principles, especially from its technology environment. And as a consequence, I would argue that the internet at the moment is the strongest projection of soft power from the West that there is. I think it makes Hollywood pale to insignificance in terms of projection of values and ideas, etc. But I'll make the point that is that the case for the time being? It is changing its nature. Its centre of gravity is moving to Asia. And it does actually pose a number of challenges, but I think a number of very important opportunities for Australia. And perhaps I'll take a chance to talk these through in some detail. Five years ago, I suppose now, I had a first number of meetings with Kofi Annan for a process which was called the UN's World Summit for Information Society. And I was faced with the challenge of meeting him for about 10 minutes. That was all he had available in his diary. And tried to explain this issue about the internet, because there were members of the UN and member states who were pushing very strongly at that stage that this big international conference should change its agenda to take over the running of the internet as one of its core functions. So I was confronted with, how do you actually talk to a man like Kofi Annan in 10 minutes and make the point? So I went in with three maps. The first one I put down, and I said, well, you know, this is the world according to politics. And he could tell he looked at his chief of staff as if to say, who let this idiot into the room? And then I said, well, that's fine, but this is the world according to telecoms. This is the world according to the National Telecommunications Union, Big Telco, Siemens, Alcatel, Nokia, those people. It's the world of cables, co-ownership, hearing arrangements for sharing of transit data or transit payments, lots of government regulation. That's the internet. And that's a map in 2001. I can't get a 2008 or 9 map. It's sort of got too big. The key point here, there's no geography. So if that's the world of politics, the challenge that he and I both face through that World Summit for Information Society, and I would argue the challenge that many political systems will continue to have, is that there's not a quaint world of that. This actually doesn't know geographic boundaries and has no other elements which are quite different to the telecommunications environment. So let me just be clear what I mean by the internet. And essentially, there are three layers of the internet. The first layer is the telecommunications infrastructure. So it really is like that second map. It is some 300,000 plus internet service providers who actually offer you the wireless and the fiber and the copper wires that all make the electrons run. Sitting on top of that is the protocols and standards, which are essentially the mathematical overlay which help those 300,000 internet service providers all operate as one single global operable internet. Excuse me. What it does mean is that uniquely every computer can find each computer on the internet uniquely, only once. This is what's called an internet system of unique identifiers. It's what ICANN essentially coordinates worldwide. And sitting above that, then, is the applications. So for many people, when they think the internet is their screen, and if it's not the screen, it's Google, that's the internet. Well, that is only one of millions of applications that sits on top of a system of coordination which sits on top of 300,000 plus ISPs that all work like that. Single, interoperable, global, with all of the content on the edge of that network, an incredibly powerful ecosystem. Sorry, I'm going the wrong way. So I want to make some key points about the internet, how it's different to telecommunications, because it's an essential thing to understand in terms of both the politics of the internet and its impact. It is, as I've already pointed out, a topological network. It's not a geographical network. What does that mean to the average user? If I was to, I'm trying to find a landline telephone, there's not one in this room, but if you take your average landline telephone that you're used to, that has a geographic number. You can't pick your phone up and go elsewhere with it. The network only operates to the number. So we have country codes, for instance, for telephones, +61 for Australia, +1 for the United States and Canada, etc. The internet is wherever you connect to it. So wherever you connect to it, it actually gives you access. Your mobile phone is mobile, except if somebody goes to ring you. If they ring you, it happens to me often, and I'm not in this country, I'm somewhere else, the phone call comes here first, and then the network here tells me that I'm not here, and this is where you can find me, and then runs back around the world and tries to find me. Right? The internet allocates me my IP address wherever I connect into whatever hotel or wherever I am. More importantly, if I take the website, let's take the Sydney Institute's website, I can quite literally change ISPs, I can change boxes, I can change IP addresses for that, still keep the same domain name, and make it move anywhere in the world. In another sense, this network doesn't recognize mountain geography. There's two things that Bob Kahn and Vint Cerf did when they invented the TCP/IP protocol, the Internet protocol. They didn't put geography in it, and they made it very dumb. By that I mean it was not like the existing telecoms and computer protocols where they were very proprietary. It's a little bit like having a train and a caboose in between flat trucks. The consequence of which is you can put anything on it. And the internet protocol will carry anything. There's telecoms protocols that are very service specific. So to give a reminder, if you might remember that we used to get every half a decade, the big telco would decide that we would get a new product. We would get ISDN, or we would get fax, or we would get whatever. Whatever the big central switches manufacturers decided was what we needed to have. Because the internet protocol will carry any form of data, voice, image, it's the people on the edge of the network who create the content who can then carry it across the internet protocol. So you can have internet television. You can have Skype that appears out of nowhere. You can have Google that's not yet 10 years old. Right? You can have et cetera, et cetera. That you can put any combinations of data in this protocol. It is a universal protocol and applies across the whole globe. And that's one of its greatest geniuses. Therefore, innovation is driven at the edge of the network. While in the old telecoms world, innovation is driven at the centre of the network. Large-scale capital, decided by large-scale companies, driven by senior management and those sorts of models. The internet, innovation is out of anyone's person's control. It is a world for entrepreneurs at the edge of the network. It's globally coordinated, while most telecom markets are nationally regulated. So you take the ACCC role here or the FCC role in the United States, they regulate telecoms environment, but the way in which the internet itself mostly coordinated is through bottom-up organisations like ICANN and the regional internet registries. And it's a very global, open, I'd say, non-governmental standard-setting body like IETF. The telecoms area has a lot of government roles, particularly in radio and other areas. So it's quite different. People tend to, when we talk a little bit here about telecoms, and I'll come to NBN and things like that in Australia, telecoms is a key part of the internet, but they are quite different in the way which their origins, and they're quite different in their politics, and they're quite different in their impact on innovation. But at the heart of the internet, it's not about bits and bytes, it's about economics. Its massive impact is it reduces transaction costs. At the heart of transaction costs is the cost of storing, collecting, and transmitting information. And the internet has done amazing things to drive those costs down enormously. And even an e-ticket for an airline costs less than 1% of a paper ticket in total costs, to give you some indication of the impacts that this technology is having on costs. And also as a consequence, because of its innovation model, it reduces barriers to entry, particularly in the services sectors. So that new people, I think there's some 4 million websites have come on so far this year worldwide. This process continues with people constantly adding new material out there for use globally. So I would argue that this is one of the most important, when we write about the history of the 20th and 21st century, this is easily as important as the introduction of electricity, steam. It's going to be that significant an issue. And when you think of the politics of the internet, the challenge I've put to you is to recalibrate your thinking. So I've sort of tried to put two comparisons there. There's the world according to CNN, and there's the world according to the internet. So the CNN thinks presidents are really important, and I think the internet still thinks communications ministers are probably pretty important. Prime ministers are important, but we think the regulators are people we've got to keep an eye on. Central bankers versus science ministers, defence ministers versus ISPs, generals versus network operator groups, and political parties versus people like the Internet Society. I want to come to network operator groups because it is the bottom-up nature of the way in which the technology was developed and is still coordinated, which is also revolutionary and really has changed the way in which not only is this a globalised technology, but increasingly it is a globalised meritocratic elite at the technical level who play quite a role in the way this world is evolving. In ways that I would argue presidents and many prime ministers have little comprehension. So recalibrate your sense of politics, because I would argue some of the most important ministers in the Middle East, not the defence ministers and the foreign ministers, but people like Tarek Kamel in Egypt, who has done a brilliant job in keeping an open, free internet operating in Egypt and promoting Egypt as a source of internet expertise. Ahmad Sabouni in Syria, a member of the Internet Society, Lamia Chafir in Tunisia, similarly, in very interesting environments, as you'll appreciate, but who are, as individuals, playing quite an important role in terms of pushing out internet values in the way that communications work in those countries. Well, in Chiang, I think one of the unspoken heroes of the internet, and his successors at the Chinese Network Information Center, some of the key architects of the long-term infrastructure of the Chinese economy and society. Because they have placed long-term commitments to the way in which the core addressing and routing systems work within the Chinese internet and how they interact with the global internet. We're all conscious in this country of the issues around railway lines, broad gauge, narrow gauge, all those issues we had in the 19th century. These are the heroes of the people who kept the same gauge railway line for the internet worldwide. And I think, look, policy experiences make this point to American audiences. People like the Malaysian Communications Multimedia Commission, with a lot of Australian input, by the way, are committing different new models to thinking about how policy gets built in this arena, no longer in the silos that have traditionally been the case coming out of the OECD type experience. So, what is, you should also recalibrate in your sense what the internet is used for. In Japan and Korea, to a degree in Europe, it is sophisticated services on mobile phones. In Japan in particular, television on mobile phones. In Africa and India, it's simple services on rapidly growing mobile phone networks. India is putting something like 8 to 9 million new handsets in service every month. 95% of the African population is presently covered by mobile telephone signal. And the present penetration rate of mobile telephones in Africa has reached 1 in 3. It's an incredible growth story. In Singapore, Japan, and Korea, On the other hand, we're moving to 1 gigabit per second fibre to the home network, a completely different sort of environment. Obviously, the government's announcements here on NBN leading to a vision of 100 megabit per second, but potentially a gigabit per second is in the catch-up mode, I argue, to the sort of thing you're seeing presently in Korea and Japan and what the Singaporeans put out to tender in February. What it's used for in the Western Pacific, what I'd argue from down the road here in some of the basements down in Sussex Street and down the end of the Pitt Street and George Street, further towards Central Station here in Sydney, from here through to Seoul, you will see often young men sitting in, you know, cheap computer access places playing real-time games as a major platform. In Korea last year, the big issue, the big item was not television. It was families competing with each other in online computer games during prime time. That was the big thing. It wasn't watching TV programs. In the US, Facebook is used for organising parties. In the Middle East, it's used for organising strikes. In China, I would argue quite strongly that the internet has become the main platform for social dialogue, including with the government. And many of you are aware there's quite a comprehensive system for surveillance in the internet in China, as it is in other places. But you've only got to see the experience in the Sichuan earthquake to see the degree to which the Chinese government utilised the internet as a mechanism, or was aware of the internet as a mechanism for understanding the feedback loop inside the society. And I think these feedback loops the internet represents, both economic, social and political, are one of its key transformative aspects. It's not like broadcasting, it's not like telecommunications, it's not like newspapers. Newspapers have letters to the editor, I suppose. But this is a real-time feedback mechanism, a feedback loop, that has its origins, I'd argue, in thoughts that go back to Adam Smith or prior to Adam Smith. It has, in many respects, a set of values in the way it works that reflect essential sort of Western economic and political values. In Costa Rica and Australia, it's used to disaggregate commodity markets, you know, people using it to sell premium merino wool versus everybody else in the space. So it's used in many ways. And I think it's a rising tide that floats all boats. But I make the point often to American audiences, it's not all American clippers, these boats. There's a tendency in the United States to see the internet purely in an American experience. The very nature of the internet's protocols empowers social dialogue. And I think that's a key aspect of it. And we've seen it in a lot of discussion about politics and what it's meant for election campaigns and what have you. But all through the process, there's a series of social dialogues that the internet empowers. I think it's almost argued one person's surveillance is another person's town hall. That these feedback loops that you see that people are accessing, they actually do tell you a lot of what's going on in society. And that the global nature of the internet allows all sorts of communities of interest and new forms of personal identity and allegiance. And that we've seen that a lot with the social networks. You know, the sort of the Twitters, the Friends, the Facebooks, the all these other sort of type of social networks. What essentially they are about is realignment of what my sense of identity is and realignment of my social allegiance. Not so much linked with geography. And as a sense, the map I showed before of the internet not showing geography is being reflected increasingly in the way which social networks are being utilised and people are utilising it. This self-definition of who my peers are, my community are, and geography has little to do with that. Connectivity has everything to do with it. I argue that the access to humanity's knowledge is the most empowering individual experience. And I was saying to Jared before, one of the reasons I'm so involved in this area is I'm passionate about it personally. It's having worked in refugee camps in the mid-1980s and having seen how people could be so disempowered. And they're disempowered because they don't have a voice. And essentially all people like myself did in that period was be a conduit and a voice. Someone who was not going to get arrested at the gate of the camp and who could actually go to an embassy in Bangkok and say X or Y, say Y. These technologies, particularly the internet, I think is an amazing empowerment of individuals. So that if a widow in Lake Victoria in Uganda sets up a bed and breakfast, every backpacker from Norway to New Zealand can access their website. And the empowerment of people being able to be in the Democratic Republic of Congo and access the best medical advice they can from wherever when there's a breakout of some virus or other, I just think we should underestimate the empowerment mechanism of this vastly growing network. And where does it come from? I talked before about these sort of changes of view of politics, but to a large degree, where it comes from is it comes from a set of technical decisions and technical communities over the last 30 years. Men are based in Europe, in North America, Europe, Japan, some here. And you can see the values of these people built into the way in which they built the network protocols. And to share some of them with you, I've already mentioned before, one of its key values is to ensure a single end-to-end interoperable internet. One is to ensure that it's bottom-up technical policy-making and decision-making, and this is radical. This is where there's the big collision with big telco. It's where you get big collision often with politics, because the model of the internet is actually bottom-up decision-making. If you go to the Internet Engineering Task Force and see the process where they go through to finalise what's called an RFC, or a request for comment, they eventually decided on the hums. They work on the fact that, do we have consensus on this? And there'll be a thousand or several thousand people in the room. You're not allowed to put your hand up because it's rough consensus. It's basically, you know, essentially we're all basically on side here. And people literally hum on the concept that you can't hum too loud. Therefore, if the hums are really loud in the room, we basically have consensus, we'll move on. Very different from my experience of working in the UN system of trying to get to consensus, where it literally is a census of everybody, and if one part is not happy, then you don't have consensus. The internet consensus model is much more a get-on-with-it type model. Participation is open to all who wish to do so. ICANN, for instance, is an organisation, but this is true for all of these so-called I organisations, is open to anyone. You can participate, you can just attend, you can attend online. There's no membership requirements. It's a very open process. Legitimacy is determined by open participation and the value of the contribution to the joint effort rather than power. In the internet, there are people in Cisco who are considered to be really, really important. They're not necessarily the board members. They're often the engineers in various parts who are considered by that part of the community to be the people you want to talk to. And I could go company by company, I could go industry by ministry. The same thing is true. What is seen in this technical community as valuable is your participation and the value of your ideas, not what your business card says. As I well know to much of my pain in previous lives. Cooperation, coordination, and consultation among participants and groups pushing forward initiatives. That's a key set of values. Very spirited and very blunt public debate. I have to tell you, these people know how to flame. They write, you know, terrible open emails to each other, which are very, you know, very critical. But it's a very open public debate. Very swift decision-making if possible. And importantly, private agreement or contract approach to creating managing linkages amongst this network. Because it doesn't sit in one jurisdiction, the model that's been used to help it grow has basically been contract. Now, look at those set of issues and frankly, read your Adam Smith again. Because they actually reflect a lot of pretty essential, I'd argue, West Anglo-Saxon, but certainly broadly Western values that have emerged over the last 700 years. The engineers reflected it in the way in which they got the work done. Global efficiency in the allocation of resources is very important to the internet community. It's one of the reasons it doesn't have geographic allocation of unique identifiers. Encouraging innovation at the fringe of the network is very important. Moving on layers of protocols, respecting the layers, having running code is very important. Standards are respected until obsolete, and at the bottom line, meritocracy. Now, I wanted to make this point because when I talked before about the sort of soft power aspects of the internet, people might think of that in terms of I can use Google to find out stuff, or I can have access to information or not, or, you know, people worry a lot about the sense that, you know, what happens when you have censorship in some countries, doesn't this diminish the impact? But at another level, at a deeper level, there is a set of values built into the way in which the technology works, built into the protocols, built into the way in which the network as a whole works, which have their own dynamic and continue to have their own dynamic. Internet organisations have tended to reflect that. ICANN is a well-known example in the internet community, but there are others. And they have, you know, they have pioneered really this idea of international multi-stakeholder organisations, but they're transnational. that all stakeholders are represented. ICANN has represents the consumers, it has nearly 100 governments participating in it, it has registries and registrars of virtual property, business constituencies, up and on. There's all sorts of people involved in the process. Flexible in organisational management, very, very concerned not to get caught with log jams, which we've seen get sovereign log jams take place in, say, you know, traditional intergovernmental organisations. Reflective and bottom-up, expert inclusive values, and focus very much on effectiveness. Again, institutional reflections of a set of values coming out of the engineering. So one of the key points that we tend to make to policymakers, and we think about this marvel, if you like, of the single global technology, is that the issues in the internet's addressing and routing system are separable from the issues arising from the content carried on that system. And why is that important? Because we don't want political processes to kill the goose that laid the golden egg. Because everyone has a content issue. Even the US, which often says, you know, we've got the First Amendment, just mention the word internet gambling, and you suddenly find out they've got a content issue. Thailand, Europe, Australia's got spam and other proposals. You know, everybody has a content issue, I'd argue. So the key question is actually, while we manage content issues, and people manage content issues on the internet, we don't use the addressing and routing systems, the mechanism in a way people try to control that. Transit policy matters in this environment, and that's why issues of how you actually run your telecoms and come back to the regulators is very important. Essentially, in Europe, Japan, Australia, and New Zealand, we have focused a lot, unless you're a greater extent of success, about having local loop competition in the access markets. The United States has probably had less success in competition for local loop level, and therefore we get a lot of this debate about so-called network neutrality, which has some aspects of issues of who bears the cost, but also has issues frankly about oligopolistic behaviour, I think, by some players. Latin America, Middle East and Africa have a different experience in many respects, summarised down. They tended to privatise or hold on to the networks and leave their telecommunications environment in areas of monopoly for quite a long period of time. Often, the regulatory frameworks did not precede privatisation, so liberalisation started later after they'd already privatised, which made it more difficult. And there's more incumbent telcos enjoying a monopoly because of deficiency, so that tends to have an impact. And that is changing over time, but that's a sort of a rough sense of the world. I mean, this is actually, the monopoly aspect is actually increasing quite significantly. Excuse me. But I just want to make the point, because transit policy matters. That's why I think all the discussion in this country about NBN and how do you have structures, how do you have regulatory reform is incredibly important, because it actually comes down to what are the terms under which you're going to get access to this most amazing phenomenon of the 21st century. I mentioned before that the internet's shifting. Most people still, I think even this country, said, where's the centre of gravity of the internet? Where's it based? A lot of people say the United States. And to a degree, in terms of its innovation, that is true. But in terms of its usage, Asia now has something like 680 million users. North Europe has nearly 400 million, North America has 250 million, and you can see the numbers go down. The most important part, and as you see, Australia and Oceania down there at 21 million. Australia's, the most important part then is to think, what's the penetration rate? In North America, it's about 74%. Australia's about the same. But once you put the other parts of the Pacific in, it comes down a little bit. The Asian number's 17%. So it's 680 million users in the internet, and it's only 17% penetration rates, and it's about the third highest growth rate continuing. Right. And that's something that we need to get our heads around. It's a very significant issue for Australia. I don't know, it's a great opportunity for Australia. It is an issue that all of the I organisations are starting to get their heads around. It is a tectonic shift taking place, and it's a tectonic shift in two ways. It is this amazing empowerment impact starting to take place in parts, like India is a classic example, where there's changes taking place in Indian society which they've never foreseen, largely at the moment because of mobile telecommunications and mobile internet. The other side of it is that the values and the way in which things are going to be used and who works it and what language it works in is all shifting. And it's shifting from the Atlantic, it's shifting from the Pacific, and the Pacific is shifting from the east to the west. not only is it shifting in usage, but also in terms of some of the most advanced usage. I have to thank the government of Japan for these slides. This is some data that they've utilised from the ITU. Average broadband prices, 100 kilobits per second in Japan, is 6 cents US. Australia's not up there, but the US number is much higher. And you'll see that Korea's 8 cents. And the speed of a technology used on copper called DSL, the top speeds in Japan and Korea are about 48 megabits per second. So they've both got the fastest networks and also the cheapest networks. Japan and Korea, Japan, KDDI put in 18 months ago 1 gigabit per second fiber to the home. NTT's been doing similar things. So this is a graph actually showing the usage rates, and I'm sorry, it's a bit hard to see. I'm doubly compounded because I'm colorblind. But if you take the green, I think it's the green one, the one that goes like this, is that green? Okay. The one that goes up like that is fiber to the home. Right, that's Kevin Rudd and Stephen Conroy's plan here. And that's presently showing about 15 million households. The one which does that is DSL, in other words, use of copper. What's interesting in Japan is when people are given the choice between copper and fiber, that I've taken fiber is growing very strongly in Japan. Multiple options. And they have some of the fastest copper access networks in the world. It's about 50 megabit per second, much faster than you can get here. But nevertheless, people are shifting to the 100 megabit and 1 gigabit per second. So the one on the axis that's going up this way is speed, and the one on the right is just numbers. Numbers over time, actually. It's numbers on the left, users on the left, over time on the right, on the bottom axis. My apologies. So the point of this chart is to say not only is Asia growing in terms of its usage, but in Northeast Asia in particular, the sophistication of the access is shifting. This is where the heart of the growth of the experience of the internet is taking place, not in Europe and not in North America. They're in catch-up mode. In Japan, their expectation is, and this is government policy, but this is their expectation that broadband, and they're saying broadband here is 20 or 30 megabits per second or more, will cover 98% of the population by 2008, and ultra-high speed, which is these 50 megabits, 100 megabits, a gigabit, is up at 89%. So we're talking in Australia today about putting in fibre to the node, fibre to the home for 8 years' time, and Japan is already there in terms of its policy expectations. Just I have to finish up now, we're close to the time, but South Asia, you see similar massive change in growth. I would just point out, the Indian government has a policy to put fibre into 600,000 villages. And because of that, their move is to bring the next 400 million users on the internet online, and they have to do it in languages apart from Roman script, English, because a billion people don't use that. And so there's a lot of move towards having 22 scripts, the 22 languages of India being reflected fully on the internet. China, I've already talked a fair degree about. I'd make the point that still continues to be one of the fastest growing experiences. I spoke to one of the governors of one of the provinces in China 18 months ago. He was halfway through a three-year plan. In the previous three-year plan, he put all the villages in that province, on telephones. In the second three-year plan, he put fibre to every administrative village in the province. So in a six-year period, they went from having quite low penetration rate, not only having copper in the ground, they had fibre as well. In a six-year period. It's quite phenomenal. Other East Asian markets are really sophisticated markets, particularly in the use of mobile internet, and the race for bandwidth supremacy is really in Japan and Korea. Pacific Islands are in a bit different space. They are all about capacity and capability. But I think very importantly, they're an interesting microcosm for a lot of developing countries. They're concerned about disruptive impacts of the internet. They're concerned what it means that they're not having skills. But they're also very concerned with the negative social impacts that have been triggered by the disease of the medium and how content can be regulated to keep the peace within multi-tribal and religiously conservative communities. And I think it's easy to parody that, but I think it's actually a very important consideration, and it's important in other parts of the world as well. ICANN has been introduced internationalised mainnames as a reflection of this. So you're used to seeing Sydney Institute. com.au. That's called a domain name. You're going to see increasingly these are going to get reflected in 100 in 100,000 characters of all the scripts of the world, as people can access it. And just to finish up then, I've sort of talked about the impact of the technology because it is global. I've talked about how the values are essentially our, if you like, Australian, the traditional Australian values, the Western values. It's shifting to the Western Pacific. And I would argue that actually gives us not only challenges, but it gives our community and our economy enormous advantages, and we should consider those. Because there are only in the Western Pacific three cities that speak all the languages of the Western Pacific: Brisbane, Sydney and Melbourne. You can't go to Singapore and get that language skill set. You can't go to Hong Kong and get that language skill set. One third of the population of Sydney speaks another language apart from English at home. That is a benefit, not something to be overcome. And in the internet networked world, our experience of immigration, our experience of new ethnic groups, our experience of who lives in our society is very different from what the ship-based immigration experience was for my generation in the 19th century, for my population in the 19th century, or people coming out in the 1950s. It's a very different environment, and we should take great advantage of that. Because these are people who speak the language sets of the fastest growing part of the internet economy. I think it gives us a great opportunity. You'll be pleased to know that eventually when we're trying to work out the politics, we didn't come to a final conclusion, but we actually left with smiles at least. So by the end of the meeting, an interesting coffee went out of his way to make certain that we had a media conference. He got the TV crews in because he wanted to send a message, contrary to what some of the right-wing media had picked up, that the UN was not trying to take over the internet, which was very important for him.
Many thanks, Paul. So we come to questions and discussion. Before we do, I should say thanks to Clayton Nicks for the use of this facility this evening. So it's time for question and discussion. Just as a lead-off, I mean, how did you go from working with the Jesuits in a refugee camp on the Thai-Cambodian border, or the Thai-Cambodian border, to running ICANN? What happened in between? And why ICANN? How did you end up there?
Yeah. Two things. Well, first of all, I was when I finished my PhD, which was actually on the search for a stable international economic and political order, 1919-1941. It's the best that I got by it. The Big Bang was taking place in London, and anybody who came out of Cambridge or Oxford was getting sucked up into sort of the commercial environment, and I ended up working for McKinsey's. And found for my joy or sins, I spent most of my time in McKinsey's working in telecoms deregulation. So I worked on telecoms deregulation here in Australia, a lot on the merger of Telecom Australia and OTC and the introduction of competition here, and then also in Hong Kong and Japan and a bit in the US. And then was asked to be the head of strategy for the Australian Trade Commission. I ran operations in Europe for a while, and then I met Barbara and others during the audience. And then when I was going back out to the private sector, Howard's government asked me if I would run this thing called the National Office of Information Economy. And when we were there, I worked closely with Clinton administration, especially IR Magazine and others at the White House, in the sort of formation of ICANN, because they were coming to the conclusion that it wasn't appropriate these rules keep getting set by single contracts from the National Science Foundation to academics. And then it was going to be an academic network, to mean commercial network. And they had a green policy, which was very American, and I said, we and others contributed partly to constant, so I got sucked up into the ICANN and also.
Thank you.
Question here? You hinted at the role of governments in regulation, and I'm thinking in particular of countries like Iran and China. Do you see that fringe users, as you've described them, will be able to overcome the regulation through their own innovation, or do you think that it needs to be governments loosening up their policies?
Well, it's not a really appropriate place to make comment about government policies on content. It's very important, this point to make. But let me make the following sort of observations. One of the things that I do see is very clever innovation on behalf of users. So users have many ways of getting around things. And the enforce that so that people get very clever at getting around things. The other thing I see, frankly, is that it has a long-term impact on what the... It is a rising tide. So the thing I do see in some of the places that have most concerns about the internet, I mean, I've had ministers, I mentioned the countries, I've had two ministers of communications from countries that have been generally received, especially in the Bush administration, part of the United States, have been particularly not nice places, and used to get lots of very bad press. I've had the communications ministers wax lyrical upon the social impacts of the internet in their country. And these are not necessarily fully free communication environments. So I do think there's something about, while that debate you're mentioning has to take place, we do need to also keep an eye on the big picture. And the big picture is if we maintain a single global interoperable internet, it actually does shift the low watermark. And we mustn't lose that. That's very important.
Slightly commercial. We're still using the 19th century model together, and how can we control the quality of information?
This is one of the key discussions in the internet. It is this question of, with the plethora, the lower the barriers to entry, and the plethora of new entrants in the information provision across all sorts of things, how do you ensure some sort of quality? What you clearly ensure is multiplicity of voice. And you could argue that, you go back in Australia 50, 60 years ago, you would have had several newspapers in some towns, but you only had one newspaper in one town. Where's the multiplicity of voice? It wasn't there. But the economics were clearly there. The economics now, I think, are more challenging. I understand that in the music industry, where there's similar sort of arguments made, there are more people today making more money out of music online than there were previously. It's just not the same aggregators. And that's the interesting question about it. It's, who's going to make money online in media provisions may not be the same aggregators as it's been in the past. It certainly seems to have an impact on the viability of newspapers.
Just the crystal ball factor.
Question. Probably it's time to be, if you had a crystal ball, where would newspapers be?
Well, I think one of the most interesting things I did recently is an argument that one of the major newspapers in the United States would actually make more money if it closed down all of its presses, gave all of its subscribers a Kindle, and provided all the information using Kindle.
Thank you.
You've got to move quickly there and there and there. Yeah, okay.
I grew up when there was no television. We used to sit around the radio on Sunday nights, so it's been an absolutely amazing change. But I also kind of wondering, what do you see as being, because it's such a marvellous thing, what do you see as being the major threat or concern that you would have for the future of the internet?
My first great concern is that somehow or other, by luck and by design, we have a single global interoperable internet, and it all works as one. And we mustn't put that a challenge. I mean, we spend how much of our resources intellectually and monetarily fighting for free trade agreements, negotiating. I think I've seen your experience and others. You haven't got to worry about that. There is no non-tariff barriers on the internet to say the censorship, but beyond that, the very things you spend all that time fighting for in agriculture, we've got given in the services sector to a degree. Right? So, we have to hang on to that. That's put at risk, that's a significant. Mercantilism of the internet would be a very bad space. One of the things that potentially is a risk there is cybersecurity issues and people's concerns about attacks and more attack capacity, but I think people respond to that. I think it's important in responding to that we don't militarise the commons on the internet. There's obviously a whole space for cyber warfare and all that sort of people, not my business, but other people worry about that stuff. But we need to make certain the commons remains an area where it's commons responsibility to have security.
There's a question there. You only had half an hour to present your talk. In your talk, it seems to be all positive. Now, as I told you before, you gave your talk, I'm reviewing several books on information technology, and in each book there is a list of negative aspects. You only mentioned in one diagram the social negative impact, but there's several others. What's your comment on the negative aspects?
There are some definitely negative aspects. There is negative in inverted commas of change. Right, so it's got, you know, the impact of the internet, to come up with this question about media, it has the same impacts, the same creative destructive impacts of other technology changes in a capitalist economy. I mean, so it has a lot of that. It also has, clearly has social challenges. I mean, people have access to information, children have access to stuff that certainly when I was growing up, according to my father who's sitting here, I didn't have access to. And so I think there's all sorts of issues, challenges of family, and that's what you're seeing in places like Australia and others, this sort of political dialogue about, you know, content regulation and that sort of stuff. It's a kitchen table issue, as they say. People responding. So I think there are without a doubt negative issues. I do think the positives outweigh the negatives significantly.
Can you tell us something about the relative size and growth of private closed use of the internet through such services as intranets as opposed to the open public?
Yeah. Jonathan Zittrain's written a lot about this recently. He's concerned at the end of the internet, as he calls it. There's going to be an ongoing tendency, particularly by large corporates, particularly, frankly, if they come to live without a telecoms environment. It's being a little unfair on telephone managers, but you can see it in Apple. You can see others who are trying to find walled gardens. So we could consider walled gardens driven by business interests as well as political versions of the same thing, which is trying to put a boundary around something. And I think what we're finding is that, at least I'm more optimistic than that than probably Jonathan is, because I think the tendencies are that other people find get around. So I'm very interested in the moment that the people who are in the business of equipment manufacturing are all concerned about getting into content. The people in content are all concerned about getting into bandwidth. The people in bandwidth are all concerned about getting into equipment manufacturers. So you're seeing everybody trying to compete with each other on the cycle, which means I think there's tendency towards that. The biggest areas of private networks are still the financial transactions. So the financial systems tend to be still very much VPN and very private networks, and probably will continue to be so. The other space I think is more using the economic strategy more towards the open network.
Yeah. And the small ones growing, or are they?
I don't think, I couldn't answer the question, I don't actually know.
Brett?
Yeah. Well, thanks very much for your presentation. I understand that there's a major problem of running out of space in terms of internet addresses and the slowness of people to move to IPv6. Would you like to comment on how that's going to be resolved?
I didn't even pay you to ask that question. What you're referring to is the protocol called Internet Protocol Version 4. It's, to use a heretical term, it's like a telephone number for computers that is now being cursed by most techies. But when you go to the URL, when you type in the domain name on an Internet Explorer, for instance, often you get that funny 12-digit number in one in the left-hand corner. That's called an Internet Protocol Address. And it is effectively the way in which computers find each other on the internet. We have 4.2 billion addresses in IPv4. I can only face them out of the original internet registries that get allocated out by ISPs. We will, the unallocated pool will be depleted, as that gets the language. The unallocated pool will be depleted, I think, sometime towards the end of next year. We have an 11-year-old technology called IPv6, and that's going to be V5, which is an experiment. It has 340 trillion, trillion, trillion addresses. Should run out in my lifetime. The challenge is to get people to understand the networks that they have to operate V4 and V6 at the same time and start using V6. Unfortunately, a lot of the carriers are struggling to find a profit line for V6. They're seeing it only as a cost. And so they're sort of waiting until they implement it. But it is very important, and it's one of the things that we need to put stress on ISPs and others, particularly in Australia and elsewhere, to make certain they do move to IPv6, because a lot of the world is moving to IPv6, a lot of Northeast Asia is moving to IPv6, we have to make certain that the networks work with each other.
Joanne?
Yes, when ICANN was set up, I believe it was in the United States. So if you're saying the structure of the internet's changing, we more focus on Asia.
Yeah, ICANN is an internationally organised multi-stakeholder organisation. It is a not-for-profit. It was founded in California because John Postel, who was doing the job at the time, who was one of the founders of the internet, happened to be employed by USC. So, yeah. I spent a lot of my life working on this issue that he's talking about. Two observations. First of all, unlike private law, non-profit law is not harmonised around the world. it's incredibly different. And so it's very, you eventually have to be somewhere, and you have to choose some place to be a non-profit, and it's very hard to do the sort of harmonisation that a for-profit organisation can do worldwide for a non-profit. To give an example, in France, you have to be a foundation, you have to have members, you have to nominate who's going to be on your, who are your councillors, you know, etc. We don't do that. ICANN has specific instruction that it has five regions of the world, and it requires its countless board members to all come from one of those five regions, and it requires equal, at least two from each region. It's the same with Commonwealth's councils for supporting organisations. So we have a structure trying to be internationally focused as we can. We do see, and I expect to see, many more Asian participation. We've seen much more participation out of India, and we expect to see much more participation out of China, and to Japan. So, yeah, it's going to shift and change.
Yes? Firstly, that's one of the most interesting talks I've heard in a long time. Wondering, I'm from the music sector where obviously there's a lot of upheaval, copyright. I wondered whether you had any thoughts about it in general and solutions.
Well, intellectual property is an incredibly important issue. It's a very important value and creation source of value. ICANN itself has to deal with issues of intellectual property in terms of domain names we've put in place. Dispute resolution processes for the existing domain names. We're looking at extending the domain name system. We've got quite a dialogue going on with the intellectual property community worldwide as the best ways to try to balance their interests and ensure their concerns. So it is very important, excuse me. I think the challenge that technology provides has been compounded by a change of behaviour by customers. And I think there's certainly an issue about the behaviour of the network generation, the kids. And I think there's going to be a challenge, a continuing challenge to provide the value. I think that's back to your question of quality. How do you continue to reinforce the value and the quality of what you've done and why that's important? And I know a lot of people in the intellectual property community talk about this a lot. And this is a challenge, and there's a challenge in the music industry. How do you reinforce that value? I have an easy answer to it. Industrialization changed all sorts of things in the commons in Europe, UK in particular, in the 18th century. You know, you're seeing a similar sort of technological change. I think the challenge is going to be very much about engagement with the consumer.
Okay, second last question. Again, very good presentation. You mentioned that for internet, different countries will have to cope with different issues. You mentioned Australia, especially for spam. Why that?
Well, the Australian government has a specific program on spam. It's been an issue for some time, previous government and present one. So I just gave it as an example. I mean, my thing I think is really big for Australia is about being a 20 million person economy in a globalised economy which doesn't have geographic boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Think about that. Right, think about that. And I'm based here in Sydney, but I travel enormously. I come back to Australia and I always get confronted with how much people talk about the economy and business, and they just think about the six states. And the Prime Minister's talking about let's have an Asian Union, let's have an European Union. Right? We've got one online. You don't need an Asian Union to do business online. The services sector, which is something like 83% or whatever of the Australian economy, huge proportions of it can be in an Asian Union now. This is a challenge of imagination. It's not a challenge of limitation. And it comes to, frankly, how do you think about all those people out there in terms of your business model? I mean, there's a certain large media company here recently I had this conversation with that publishes everything in English. And yet for one of its major mastheads, its third largest city market is Singapore. So if you thought about the fact that this is a unique place for the skill set, there were one of the export award winners last year is a company called Appen in North Sydney, which does Chatsworth, does enormous sort of complex language stuff with all sorts of languages all around the world. It's sourced here because it knows it can access the skill set. So for me, there's an issue of, if I look at that map which has no geographic boundaries, I think about an economy of 20 million people, then I say, what are the skill sets you can mobilise to get value out of that global economy? And I think, if you want my unique Australian thing, that's my unique Australian thing.
I've got a question. don't want to be the sour point on that, but if Japan and Korea have got this fantastic speed and the most up-to-date internet connection, why are their economies not doing better?
Well,
because it seems they spend an awful lot of money and invest an awful lot, and I'm not against any of that, but it doesn't seem to have translated for them into more profitable or more successful.
We're going to make this the final question, so... And the question goes back to...
Where's the problem between economics and the net? I mean, there's something still not happening.
Right. Well, what was then Communications Technology and the Arts Department did a recent kind of studies in the mid-2000s, early-2000s of economic growth in Australia in the previous decade. And something like... 3/4 of the productivity improvement in the Australian economy came from ICT employment. And that's during a period of time when labour productivity, labour markets are being changed and everything. The two reinforce each other. I think you'd find in Japan, if you did a similar study of productivity improvements, that ICT has been incredibly important. And I think the Japanese government, one of the reasons I've got that chart about the Japanese government's policies on large-scale employment is because they're now shifting their attention to how to use this to solve society's problems, particularly an ageing population. So I think you can do the analysis in the Australian economy and see the productivity improvements. I'm not aware of the exact numbers in Japan. But... It is. It's about productivity improvement. That's where the key elements returns are.
Many thanks,
Paul.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Well, many thanks to Paul Tim for what was a fascinating night, an important talk followed by a most engaging question and discussion period. Paul has been a hugely successful Australian in this whole area, and it's great to have him come to the Sydney Institute. During some of his time here in Australia to tell us about A, what he's doing and B, what the industry's doing and C, the great opportunities and continuing opportunities for Australia in this whole area. So tonight, Paul Timmy, many thanks for a great talk. It'll be up on our podcast. CAPAC is here, channel 607 on Fox, Foxtel. We'll put it on our podcast and publish the paper in time now. Sydney Papers. But tonight, many thanks. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.